Hey there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, we hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we've got Mr. Bill Webb, our special guest, head of Necromancer Games, makers of some of our favorite products in the last quarter century, with a Kickstarter for his new in-house rule set, The Necromancer's Game. All that and more today on Wandering DMs. So, Bill, thank you so much for joining us. We've kind of wanted to talk to you for quite some time, actually. So I'm actually delighted that we got to arrange this. Thank you so much for being here today.
Absolutely. I'm happy to join you guys anytime you want me.
That is fantastic. So we have been huge fans of Necromancer Games since you started in 2000. Some of our favorite products and, frankly, just our favorite feel and you know, understanding of what D&D and our favorite fantasy role-playing game should be. So I'm really kind of jazzed that Necromancer Games is coming out with its own custom rules, The Necromancer's Game. And thank you for giving us a secret preview of that. Maybe just tell us for viewers that this is new for and that might join the Kickstarter right now, the general skinny of what it's about.
Absolutely. So basically, I've been playing for enough years that I recognize and used the back screen that you guys have there, the outdoor survival board. And so back in the day, I used to be when I was about 10 or 11 years old, I was a avid sand table tank gamer, and I actually still am. So I probably have more World War II miniatures than almost anybody anybody who's at least sane in the world. And I used to go to the hobby store and play tank battles with sort of like all the old guys my age now, right? And so it was all these old World War II vets playing tank battles every Saturday and Sunday at the local hobby store. So I'd ride my bike up there and play tank battles. And one day I was watching these dudes who were playing like with dominoes and like kid building blocks. They all had one model of some dude, right? They all had one little toy soldier. And I asked him what the heck they were doing, and they said, oh, it's this game, Dungeons and Dragons. And this other than about, I think it was November of 76. And anyway, they asked if I wanted to play, and I you know, rolled up a cleric and played in Teagle Manor, of all things. I was the only survivor in the group or whatever, because I got some sort of scroll from a statue that let me like get rid of the skeletons and the some other monster that was, which scared the hell out of me, because of course all I had was Harryhausen skeletons in my brain. And made them all run away, and so I survived. And so I ended up meeting these guys, and there's a guy named Steve Peterson, there's a guy named Buck, I don't remember his last name now, and then Richard Oliver was another guy. There was somebody else, I don't remember who it was, but Rich actually does our layout for us. He's the guy you'll notice he's also on the cover of this. Right. Way when we were in high school, and I ran into him at Gen Con about 10 years ago, and now he does a lot of our graphic design work, because he actually found some old manuscripts of mine that I had lost, that he'd Xeroxed on one of those ammonia machines, the mimeograph machines, when he moved to Alabama from Washington. Anyway, so the problem was I was the youngest one, and so they made me be the DM, and thinking they could take advantage of me. And I think anybody who's read any of my stuff knows that that didn't last very long. I think they chose poorly to have an easy route for their characters to become powerful. Steve was part of Balboa Games. And I don't know if you guys know, you guys are probably old enough, you actually know what I'm talking about, but it was Warlock and Warlock's Menagerie. And they, of course, they got knocked out of business by TSR in about 78, and couldn't publish those books anymore. They're quite valuable if you've got copies of them. But Steve printed out, he was part of Caltech Gamer Society, and he printed out these rules on that green and white, you know, dot matrix printer paper. Rich still has his, actually. He still has his copy of that. So one of the things that was really interesting about learning how to play in the white box era, when there were some other stuff out there, I think Game Lords came out in about 1980 with Thieves Guild and not World, that's Robert Asprin, but Thieves Guild, and you know, Arduin was starting to become around. I think the first three books were out, was that we sort of had to make up the rules because White Box was very, very ambiguous, right? And so I don't know anybody who runs White Box that hasn't added a lot of rules to it, just because there's not a rule for very much. And so luckily for me, and hopefully everyone will agree with this when they buy the Kickstarter, go to Kickstarter, I actually wrote all those rules down that we had as house rules. And so there were things like the lore check or the way you would negotiate and parlay, because the parlaying was a big thing. I've never been much of a murder hobo DM, contrary to popular belief. You know, if you try and murder your hobo your way through Rappahannock, you're going to be a grease spot. You need to be able to kind of negotiate your way through and pick and choose your fights. And so I wrote all that stuff down. So, you know, here we go. You know, we played that way all through college, and my home game is always run sort of on a modified white box rules. Which you've seen and you have that copy of. But I wrote them all down, and then I was, you know, 3.0 happened, and I was in the right place at the right time and got picked up to own the studio that published White Wolf and Monty Cook and those guys, and of course my own imprint with Necromancer. And then 3.0 happened, and we did 3.0 stuff for a while. And I wrote a lot of books for 3.0, and I've maybe played it 5 times. Right?
Interesting.
So I didn't. I had the joke about me was they had to. We actually had to hire, a 20-hour week rules guy, because I was producing a lot of material. To just do rules for my stuff, because I just didn't, I was never going to, you can't teach this old dog too many new tricks. I play, you know, AD&D I can write to, I'm really a white box guy, Swords and Wizardry, you know, that I worked with Matt on for a long time. And that's one of the better systems out there. All those things are real easy for me because they're basically modified OD&D, right? So they're not, you know, I don't use the weapon speed and the different armor class stuff and everything else from AD&D, but yeah, I can play AD&D and have a lot. And so I wrote all that down. So fast forward into the future, fourth edition happens. We shut down for a couple of years. Then Pathfinder happened. I played Pathfinder twice. And I think we were probably the third or fourth largest producer of Pathfinder books as well. So, you know, I don't understand it. It's, you know, it's got way too many rules for me, and I screwed up some of Greg Vaughn's games by, like, you know, disintegrating his 15-minute description of a door. It was probably some horrific puzzle trap thing we were supposed to go into, and then I just pass wall drilled through the dungeon to get to the end. But we published a lot of stuff for that. And about the time that I started Frog God, and I'll explain that real briefly, is which that Clark became a federal judge. He couldn't really be involved anymore because he lives in Northern Idaho and they didn't like that satanic stuff he was doing. And so Necromancer shut down. And then, so I started Frog God as a separate imprint, because I wanted to publish and I couldn't publish under Necromancer because of Clark's situation. And then we bought him out a few years later. We bought him out of Necromancer. And so now we own both. We own both companies. And so Frog God has everything associated with my home game world, which is called the Lost Lands. And I don't know if you guys have ever seen that 800,000 word monstrosity, but it's a giant world setting, and that's been the basis of my home campaign since I was, you know, a teenager. I have the original map. My wife got it framed for me a few years ago. My original watercolor and hand drawn map is above our dining room table. So it's I also married well. and of course, the Teagle Manor map is above my mantelpiece, the real one from Halloween of 73 that Bob drew. And you can see the Otis painting around here. I've got a lot of little niche stuff from the old days, I guess. But anyway, so I was going to publish these rules of Wonder Frog God. I resurrected all my notebooks and I went and started writing them and, you know, got some files so we could put together that kind of thing. And then I got a phone call from Matt Finch, who, was really sick of doing the business side of the business and wanted to see if I was interested in collaborating and working with him. And so we acquired Mythmare and had Swords and Wizardry. So I didn't publish my rules because why would I? You know, why would I publish a second set of rules when we had Swords and Wizardry? And it was close enough to what I played that it worked just fine for me. And then, you know, since Matt started, Matt ended up doing all the business stuff at Frog God Games again, and I don't think he liked that very much. And he went off to do his own thing again, and guy does great work, man. He's really top notch dude. But then we don't have Swords and Wizardry anymore, even though of course we could publish stuff for Swords and Wizardry, but it's not our game. And so about 2 years ago, maybe two and a half, Richard started bugging me about, Bill, just publish the rules we played with. Publish the rules we did way back in the day. And what those rules are is what you see is in the preview of the kind of what that's sort of the first quarter or something of the unedited version of the Player's Handbook, is I called the Necromancer's Game. And it's a white box game that has, you'll find little tidbits from about 15 different sources in it, including one from my friend over at Arcane Library, Kelsey, where I got rid of the Continual Light spell. That spell always ticked me off, so it no longer exists.
Interesting.
I'm having to worry about light as a resource, and in my game you do, and nobody has Enfervision either. So I already told Kelsey I was blatantly stealing that idea from her, and she said great. So I've written, I want to say this, I think the total box, it's going to be a sexy box set, because like I explained earlier, I'm the CEO. So I'm making three hardcover books in what could best be described as a big iPhone box. And there'll be a big poster map. I'm really proud of this. My daughter and my son are both avid gamers, and they didn't have a choice, but you know, they've been running games at cons since they were under 10. Jillian and I sat down. She's in nursing school. She works at the bar that's half mile from our house as a bartender. So once I get there on slow days with me and the dog and her, and we designed these encounter tables, which are, they're reminiscent of the first edition DM guide, where they have the different biomes across one way and that kind of thing. And then but they're sorted by rarity. But I did it for 240 monsters, and it includes stuff that I always included, like you find ancient ruins, or you find an island along the river, or you find a lake, or you find an NPC party, or you find it, or you get caught in a trap that somebody set. And so it's got a bunch of non-monster encounters as well as monster encounters. But we did D1000 tables. I think we figured out it's 40 pages of encounter tables. It's 1,000 base, 40 page encounter tables. And then we're doing a giant poster of all of them that's kind of formatted a little differently, so it fits on like a 3-foot by 3-foot piece of paper. And that'll be the box. Yeah, it's pretty good. The encounter tables are fixed. I'll have one of those. There's one of those up on the Kickstarter page that people can download and take a look at. I'm putting the mountain encounter table on the Kickstarter, because we had a hilarious error in it, where a typo converted the number 2 to number 5, which, you know, I'm not that great of a typist, right? Werewolves occurred about 35% of the time in the mountains, instead of 3% of the time in the mountains. So my husband still uses that encounter table for his convention games. All of his events are called the Howling Mountains, and so you encounter lots and lots of werewolves. But it's got a poster book. It's got about a 200 page monster book of kind of the handpicked monsters that I use mostly in my game. They're all, you know, set up to run with any white box game or anything else. The Player's Handbook has 11 character classes, because one of the things I really liked was having the ability to have druids and bards and rangers and paladins. And I James Spawn's done a couple things like that in White Box, but they didn't really kind of fit the look and feel of what my rules were. And so I rewrote those. I rewrote all those classes myself to really match kind of the theme and mechanisms that I use. And then the Dungeon Master's Guide, can't call it that, of course, it's called the Game Master's Guide, is about another, so I think Player's Handbook's about 120 pages or something, and then I think the Dungeon Master's Guide or the Game Master's Guide is about the same, maybe a little more. I think it's going to be more like 150 pages, because it's got the encounter tables in it as well.
I get the impression, Bill, that you do very, that you don't really do small things, it sounds like, which John... our first encounter with you at GaryCon, where Dan and I found ourselves accidentally in a 26-player game.
Was I walking on tables still?
Yeah, yeah.
I was still young enough to walk on tables, so that's been a few years.
I mean, just out of curiosity, are the books this kind of half pamphlet size, or are they full 8.5 by 11?
They're gonna be this size. So the idea, I wanted something that looked and felt like a white box game. The box probably won't be white; it'll probably be black or brown. Though that's still the tariff stuff. That's TBD because we're not exactly sure whether we're printing in the U.S. or China right now. But I think there's one size, it's like 6 by 9, so it's a little bit bigger than this.
Yeah. Okay.
So they're gonna be like the size of the OSE books or something like that. Sort of like the, you know, my friends at Dungeon in a Box, something like that, right?
Nice.
Just because the font had to get a little too small to keep it the trade paperback size. And it made particularly the magic item tables for old guys like me hard to read. And so, because all the magic items are new, right? There's still plus one sword or something like that, but all the magic items are tailored to the specifics of the game. And so I've got three big tables of magic items and with descriptions of them. And I've got, including the mundane ones, which everybody really likes. Those are like the blanket of comfort that lets you, you know, recover 2 hit points a night when you sleep in it, and little mundane stuff like that. I like to add sort of flavory stuff in there. What else do you guys want to know about? Let's see. The other thing too that I really was careful about with this, and this is just for anybody who, you know, is completely married to Shadow Dark or married to OSR, OSE or whatever it is really, with the exception of a couple of rules, and really the character classes would have to be from your regular system, whatever it was, whether it's Hyperborea or Shadow Dark or whatever. The monster book and the DM book are really usable with any system. And I put a lot of stuff in the DM book that includes things like settlement sizes, you know, what kinds of things you can buy based on the settlement size. I think those encounter tables are, you know, they're probably worth the price of admission just by themselves. Because they're not just monsters, you know, they're, like I said, it's lots of other stuff. So I tried to make it so it was pretty versatile. So I think when people see how easy this game is to play, well, you guys have seen it before because you played with me, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you did. And like, I finally named the D6 rolls I was making everybody make, which is called the lore check. And it's not necessarily lore was the best word I could come up with, but it basically is, you know, the fact that, you know, a paladin would know, you know, that the heraldry that he sees across the field in battle was the Chaos Knight, you know, or whatever. And the, you know, the thief would be able to gather information in a tavern by using a charisma check of some sort. So that's called a lore check. I have several hundred examples detailed out of typical things you could use that for. That's sort of the, how does the DM pick how to have your role to see if you know something, because there's no real rules about it.
I thought that was nice, and as someone that's a fan of White Box, and Paul and I play you know, White Box adjacent game ourselves,
adjacent.
That was the one thing that kind of jumped out as novel and interestingly unique is each of the character classes has a paragraph on what kind of lore checks can they make specifically. So I thought that was probably the number one thing that kind of popped out at me in the class descriptions. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's there's a significant level of detail in that I've added since the draft, so to make it more clear. Yeah. My editors, I've got a really good editing team, and they do a much. This was completely unedited, except by me, written by me, edited by me, and a little bit by my wife. When Edwin and Jeff got a hold of it, they made it a lot clearer and it also expanded the size of it quite a bit because they made me write a bunch of new stuff and add spells in. I think the rules for, or at least the draft of the rules for parlaying and morale and that kind of thing are in here. They're also in the revised version with the one on the Kickstarter has a significantly better explanation of how all that stuff works. And
great.
Including the operational example of, you know, a play that sort of goes through all the different, or most of the different mechanics. for the individual character classes and the parlay checks and the morale checks and the, you know, the lore checks and that kind of thing. You know, and it's like, it's kind of interesting because it ends up with, Zeb Cook's one of my regular players, right? So Zeb and his wife Helen play in my Sunday game. Yeah, we play all the time. We live right by each other. We've been friends for years. And so he's helped me a lot with making sure the rules work. He's a lot better rules dude than I am, I guess, is the way to put it. And it's funny because they
much more esteem than that, yeah.
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, the guy wrote second edition and about 10 other games. We always tease him about the All My Children game, of course. he's gotten to the point. Yesterday, we played for about 5 hours with all 12 of my players were there. Everybody except for my son, who's in Indiana right now. So we had all 12 players there, and they didn't actually fight anything yesterday. So they were able to negotiate. Yeah. They ran into a big cave bear and they did the druid parlayed with the cave bear. That was really effective. And so they were able to, make that happen. But one of the interesting things with it is they've actually gotten to the point sometimes where they've made friends with like a pack of wolves. And because they've rolled really well and they've, with a high charisma person that can speak with animals and that kind of thing. And they've, had a collaborative battle where they go hunt down a hill giant that's pissing the wolves off. And so they collaboratively go after and were able to kill the hill giant when they were like third level because they had a wolf pack helping them. You guys know from playing White Box, man, you don't want to fight a lot of stuff. I mean, you're fragile, right? You might have 4 hit points, And so if you do too much fighting, your odds of surviving to the next level are pretty low. And
it's not a sport, it's a war. You have to, viciously and stack as many things on your side as possible.
Absolutely. And if you need to run, you need to run. I mean, that's the thing that I think a lot of people have forgotten is that you can always run away. And
out of curiosity, I'm curious if you have any, do you have any rules around the deadliness of, do you play with just zero is dead? Or have you done anything to...
Are you negative your level? I've always done negative your level. So if you're a third level character, you die at -4. If you're a first level character, you die at -2, that kind of thing. I always found it made a little bit of a difference. If you're going to die that round, they can still save you on their initiative that round. And so, had a couple of things like that where a neutralized poison spell or something, the person gets bit by the snake, they go down, they're dead. But they get the neutralized poison on that round. I let them live. But you're dead next round.
I feel like most people who play the older editions, I feel like that's like both the most commonly house ruled thing is to do something extra that to put a line between zero and dead. And yet I feel like everyone I ask that question to has a different answer. It's house ruled in a different way. Pretty much by everybody.
Yeah, I thought -10 was too generous.
Yeah, and, I agree.
Especially if your wizard has 3 hit points, and that really gives you 13 hit points before you're dead, which is kind of goofy. Negative your level seemed good and fair. Zeb, of course, kills everybody exactly at 0 because you go to 0, you're dead. Yeah. And he's brutal.
Does he, if you have Zeb at your table, does he ever rules lawyer you? Does he ever dispute, that's not the way it's supposed to be? Okay,
no, all right. No. He'll tell me, sometimes he'll be like, that's a really stupid rule, Bill, you should change that. It'd be like, okay, we had some issues with the sleep spell, and he was like, okay, it's just, theoretically, because I always treat it like a fireball. And so, because it has a range, you can kind of center that fireball wherever you want to center it. Right.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, nowhere in any OD&D thing or anything else does it tell you how big it is. Right. So like it says range is 160 feet. Was that everything within 160 feet or not? I don't know. I think that might be from AD&D, but anyway. So we put a 30-foot radius on it or 30-foot diameter on it, type thing. And that was at his suggestion. I know that one of the things you guys will see on the Kickstarter is there's an expansion pack And that's got, you know, it's got some of the stretch goals in it and stuff like that. But there's like a witch class. There's a, and I'll get the, yeah, I'm addressing your Zeb question with that particularly, but there's like a witch class, a necromancer class, because they wanted me to do a necromancer class because we're necromancer games. There's a goblin class, a lizard man class, a barbarian, and something else. Oh, an illusionist. And anyway, so I had the crew review. Everyone showed up a little bit early yesterday. I had them all pass around the new character classes to kind of like evaluate them. And Zeb and Helen, his wife, were a little bit late to the game. And so everybody was telling me, yeah, the witch is too powerful. The witch is too powerful. And I just didn't see it, you know? And anyway, so I go, okay, nobody say a word. Zeb gets there. I'm like, Zeb, witch class, review this. You tell me what you think. And, you know, it's like six pages or something. So he reads it for about 5 or 10 minutes. And he goes, why would I ever play a wizard? This thing's so much better. And I was like, okay, I'm stand corrected. You guys are right. I made it too powerful. So we're scaling that one back a little bit. But yeah, he does. So he tells me when I'm full of BS, but he doesn't really rule as long lawyer me at all.
I'm glad you're thinking about it. So I am constantly looking at those old spells, still tweaking them a bit. Like I have a product called Book of Spells where I have my massaged versions of those same things. I was just continuing. I mean, after 20 years, I was just playtesting the next edition yesterday, frankly. With some folks, so that's very much on my mind. I will, because I'm this kind of guy, I gotta point out that with the sleep spell, Gary, yep, in Swords and Spells, right, for original D&D, yeah, two, yeah, years after, yeah, publication, did add the 1-inch diameter to the sleep spell. So okay, it makes sense to all of us. It's canon as of 76.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I've got a couple, yep, copies, exactly, of it. I had never considered, yeah, looking there for the diameter of the thing. So he actually made it. So outdoors is 30, yeah, feet then, right? Cool. Hey, I guess, right.
They hadn't come up with that being an issue yet. So it was like a year after that he had an article in Dragon that said, you better look at the area as feet. But right. I think that had been out to him that was an issue.
Yeah, thought it was until 1 inch indoors. It's 1 inches and feet indoors and yards outdoors, right?
That's 30 what foot, the book right, said.
30 foot diameter. That makes sense.
Yes. Yes. So correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So that makes
exactly
sense.
Correct. Yeah. Some of us look at swords and spells kind of like it's errata to some stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll tell you what's funny, Bill, because I'm of the age where I was just slightly too young to get started with White Box. So I think it was in stores, but I got, you know, the BX system to begin, yep, with. Well, actually, I got the home system, and I ran a lot of, yep, BX that Zeb Cook had a hand in. This was actually, yep, my first digest-sized book. It's funny, I had this, wow, for decades before I actually got the White Box rules. And I kind of, when I saw the White Box rules, I fell in love with it. And I've kind of been running since that for a couple decades now. So yeah. I love people that can talk about running games in that way. You know, look, okay, yeah, I got to ask this. So there is, right, so if I look at original White Box, yeah, rules, and Paul and, yeah, I, okay, Paul knows where I'm going with this, right, is on page 5, it says, there's a thing here that says number of players. You got to, for original D&D, at least one referee, and from 4 to 50 players can be handled in a single campaign, but the ratio should be around 1 to 20. And newer, you know, younger folks, that blows their mind. They go, what are you talking about? And they'll say, I can't handle more than 5. And the fact that we got to play with you a couple times at GaryCon, I usually point to you as a great example of someone that we've seen run 26, 27 people in a room, and we had a blast, and it was great, and it was snappy, and it was fast. So yeah. I kind of want, like, what does it feel like? Does that feel like normal to you, or were those events like crazy, unusual things to happen?
Yeah, my home group's only 12 right now because my son and godson are in college, and then two of my players are in the Navy, and they're on the Nimitz and somewhere in the South China Sea. So usually we have 16 during the summer. We have 16 players in my home group, and it totally feels normal. And really all it is, I mean, you know, from you run a white box game, I've made it so that in the way I run games, nothing can't be resolved by two dice. The maximum dice rolls you're ever going to make for anything you want to do is two dice rolls. It's not going to be, you're not adding 55,000 different things to it. It's okay. And most of the time you're rolling two dice, it's to hit and damage. So, you know, if you're trying to solve a puzzle or the thief's trying to pull the green wire instead of the red wire, you know, and he has a thievery ability, roll a d6. You know, that's all you gotta do. So it goes really fast. And, yeah. You know, things like group initiative. There's a whole section on this in the Game Master's Guide about how to run a big game, by the way, and why this really works and lends itself well to big games. Just because the rules are super simple. I hate getting bogged down in a bunch of rules stuff. You know, it's supposed to be ROLE playing game, not ROLL playing game. I mean, tactical is always ROLL, right? But unless you're fighting, it's supposed to be a role-playing game. And I think if you apply a spot check and a charisma test and if you got five dice rolls going on to resolve a simple action, you can't play a lot of people in your game. And so, you know, I always looked at, and nothing wrong with that. I mean, people love Pathfinder, right? But I always called it Mathfinder because you could be rolling six dice to determine whether or not you could paddle the boat. Six die rolls, no kidding, to see if you could paddle a boat across a swiftly moving stream. It took six die rolls to cross the river. And I mean, and that's, you know, for people who really like crunchy stuff, that's great. I couldn't envision running a large group of players with that many rules and that many dice rolls, I guess. So,
you know, I'll say that as we record this 2 days ago on Saturday, I was running a session of old type D&D, and I was pleasantly surprised that as time was running out of our session, I had seven players, so seven characters. They got jumped by 15 zombies. And we right. played out the whole, kind of at their request, we played out that whole fight, I think, in about 2 minutes flat. We had four rounds of combat. And the players, to their credit, organized, like, let's just have all seven of us just roll, bam. And we'll tell you how many points of damage we scored. And great. Right. And I grab a fistful of D20s myself. I go, here's a bunch of attacks at you, bam, and parse them out. And we could just go back and forth like that four times in 2 minutes and get the whole fight done. And I agree with you. That is not something that you can possibly do with newer brands of D&D.
No, you really can't. And I mean, like I said, I'm not taking a shot at Fifth or Pathfinder or whatever. This is not the game I play. But the part of the charm of kind of old school D&D, and you know, the negative is there were no rules, so you had to make them up. But the positive was that you know, you got to make them up. And so if it makes sense, roll with it, right? I mean, if it makes sense to me that the lightly armored 16 strength fighter could swim across the river, but the heavily armored 8 strength thief probably couldn't because he was encumbered or something, right? Or whatever that is. You know, the magic user or whatever, because he's got a 3 strength. He might have trouble swimming the river. And so you just kind of say, well, yeah, you know, you don't think you could make it, man. And, you know, and you can try, and then we'll roll some dice and see if you succeed. But you know, you sort of have to use common sense, and if it makes sense, then have it make sense, I guess. I've also got this whole section in the Game Master's Guide what to do if there's no rule. It's just like, you know, basically, you know, it doesn't make sense, right?
I think that's good practice for younger DMs to embrace that, actually. You know, it's funny because I think I saw there's one thing in these rules that is dogmatic in a way that I like, and that is that you have very consciously reduced it to just a D20 and a D6. And I think that I saw you doing that at GaryCon. I liked it, and I think probably somewhat inspired by that because you just had two dice with you. You had a big big D20 and a big D6.
I think that you were talking about
the same thing at some point. Yeah, right.
About here's the D6. So I got
even bigger than I have.
My D20, my D6. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So
exactly.
So I got to tell you the dice story now. This won't take very long. But let me digress. So I was at Gen Con in 2000.
Because it's visible at the table. I'm sorry, Bill. So I mean, it's so I do that totally. With if I have seven players, yeah. This is visible to everybody. And if you have like 25 players, you need bigger dice than I have.
There you go. Well, the dice thing was so this is it gets back to the size of the group. Gen Con 2010, I think, might have been 2011. They screwed up, and you know I run all my games at night, right? Because I'm just not a morning person. I work in the morning and I write in the morning, but once you know when it's showtime, I got to have been awake for several hours, or I'm not as good. And anyway, they screwed up and scheduled one of my games for 0800, not 2000, right? Hours, and so instead of 8 o'clock at night, Skeeter Green's wife shaking me awake. She kicks you. Basically, Skeeter and her had a key to my room and everything else. And she comes in to wake me up. You got a game in 10 minutes. I'd gone to bed at like, 5 a.m. or something, right? And so it was like, I was up all night playing games with people. And so she shakes me out of bed. You got a game in 5 minutes. And I sort of, throw clothes on and stumble out. Stopped at the ChessX booth downstairs by the elevator and bought these two dice for $20. I had a $20 bill in my pocket. I walked into a room to see 32 bright-eyed, bushy-tailed D&D players waiting for me. I had two dice. That's all I had with this. The only thing I had with me was two dice. And, I didn't even bring a jacket. I didn't have my wallet or anything. And so, so I ran. And that's, have you guys ever seen the adventure character killing session that I wrote?
No, not me.
You know, with the sword, no, it's a limited thing. With the sword, there's PDFs of it around. I'll make sure Zach gets you guys one. They're like, okay, well, what do we roll for characters? I'm like 3d6 in order. Okay, great. And pick your character class. Whatever you want to be. You can be that character class. And they're all like, okay, and they're all psyched. And I kind of felt like a jerk because these guys, Gen Con charges a massive amount of money for people to play, and they charge by the hour. And my game was listed as a 6-hour game or something. So these dudes had shelled out like $120 to play in my game. No, I didn't get the money. It was the Gen Con, but it was like $120 ticket. But they asked me how limited the table was. I said, however many you show up. I expecting 15 to 20, right? But no, 32. Basically, they're like, what about equipment? I said, well, you don't have any. What? You don't have any equipment. You're naked in a cave. And you see glowing lights. The idea is, the survival test thing where you got to kill the fire beetles to get the light sacks out of them by throwing rocks at them, and then you find some stuff throughout the dungeon. You find a salt deposit, use that to kill the giant slug, and you find a shocker lizard, you throw him in the river so you get past the giant eyeless fish that'll eat you because it zaps the fish and they belly up. You got to find there's like a teddy bear thing that you got to find because the gray render wants it so it doesn't kill you, it's all like a puzzle survive test. And the trick is, of course, the big boss monster at the end is an ancient blue dragon. And so the intelligence test is, do you escape or do you go try and kill the dragon with your rocks and sticks? They didn't kill the dragon. I think 5 or 6 of them got out alive by running. All the other 25 of them attacked the dragon and got squished, but it was weird. It was wicked fun, and I ended up making that into a book. And so it, one of the things you guys will notice about me is I never run anything that's been published. So everything I run at cons is always fresh and new.
Great.
And then my son has finally got me taking enough notes that I'm able to convert it into new manuscripts now. And so he yelled at me and he's like, well, remember that adventure? I'm like, I don't remember. What do we do? And they're like, he's like, Jesus, Dad, you didn't write it down? No. And so anyway, so like the adventure I ran at Gary Con on Saturday night this year is actually in the Kickstarter. And it's called, what the heck did I call it? Something or other involving a blood moon, it's sort of what my friend Michael Potter describes as a Mensa test, of puzzles and riddles and that kind of thing, culminating in a pretty nasty vampire fight at the end, but it's, I'm pretty psyched about it. And then I also, the one I ran for Tower Gygax, which is basically a character killing session that I did for Luke, is also going to be in the expansion pack. It's sort of it's named after my son's Shadow Dark character from Kelsey's game. which is he's Sneech. He's a goblin cleric, and so he's it's his tower after he's grown up and retired, and which is pretty funny. But yeah, so anyway, so where do you want me to go next, man? I can talk for years. So
it's so funny that the to me, and I've written blogs and I've said it on our show in the past, like I kind of wish there was a version of D&D that just had D20s and D6s. That would be very elegant, very elegant design aspect, and then come and find out that it happened to you by accident. And it's so funny sometimes with game design that we stumble into these great design elements kind of by accident, and maybe to outsiders it doesn't look like that, but boy, there's a lot of a pleasure of discovery of like exploring like what works at the table like that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and it really, that's the other thing, by only having two kinds of dice, if you want to talk about something that speeds up the game, man, that speeds up the game a lot. And so it's you're not having to look in the rule book to say, oh yeah, you roll a d8 for that or whatever it is. And I guess the one exception is the encounter tables, because they need 3d10, but that just means roll your 20-sided dice three times, you know, and do math. Yeah. But because I couldn't do a d20 encounter table and have 40 pages of encounter tables. So,
right.
So there's that.
Right. And, you know, I'll say new players, like I find that they really, it's very common that they pick up the d12 by accident for their two-hit roll. And then you got to go around and make sure they didn't do that. And that's a really common problem for.
God, I rolled another 5. I rolled another 7, and it's like, that happened. I've seen that happen a lot. I had, it's not even necessarily new players. I have a gal that plays in like most of my convention games. You guys have probably played with her, and her name's Sarah. She's just a lovely, lovely, lovely woman. She and her husband are in like every con game and at Gary Con that I run every time. And
she normally has like a ranger. Normally, a lot of the time, is that right?
Yeah, a lot of times she plays a ranger. No, you're thinking of Melody. You're thinking of Melody. That's the stands.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, yep. There you go. There you
but,
go.
But Melody doesn't mess up her dice. But she's the Teflon Ranger. Sarah plays a thief usually. I think for the last 2 years she's had a thief character. In all 6 games she played with me in. She did that on Saturday night at Gary Con this year. She just couldn't make a roll to save her life, and she suddenly after about the 10th thing into it, realized she was rolling a D10, not a D20.
No.
She's been rolling a D10 to hit for every attack. And she's like, God, you know, I'm like, okay, you know, its armor class is -2, you know, 5th level thief, you know, so you get +3 on your roll and you got +4 for backstab and +1 for your strength. And so she's like, okay. And she goes, so I don't, you need an 11 to hit it or whatever. And she's like, God, I rolled a 1. You know, it's like, she didn't really. She might have rolled an 11. She was rolling a D10 for like 2/3 of the adventure. And much to the party, she was the glass cannon thief, right? So, but yeah, it does happen, though. I know exactly what you mean.
Let me ask you about another thing that jumped out at me in this book. Is I'm looking at a list of character classes and noticing things like dwarf and elf.
Yep.
And I think that's fascinating because it's like the only other edition of the game I know that does that, right, is BX. So what led you down that road of rolling?
It's just the way I've always played. I mean, I obviously modified that a little bit when I was running a lot of Sword and Wizardry games, because one of the things Matt and I did for 15 years is if you play characters from his game, you can play them in my games. And if you play characters from my games, you can play them in his games. And we did that because we've sort of had a campaign thing going since 2010. And that's diverged a little bit now that I'm doing things a little differently and he's doing his own thing again. But if you still have a character that you roll for me, you can play it in Matt's game and vice versa, pretty much, right? Just you have to, change the rules might change a little bit. The idea there being, I've always done races class. And like I said, in the expansion pack, you'll have the option of lizard men and goblins too. Goblins mostly because my kid really wanted there to be a goblin class because he loves his Shadow Dark Goblin. I always thought lizard men were viable anyway. The racist class thing, and again, I gave them sort of different abilities, I think, than conventionally they've gotten. Because elves were just too good, right? And so one of the things we spent the last couple of years doing, because this has been these rules have been playtested now by a couple of hundred people, probably. And of course, you know, and with Jillian and Johnny and Zeb, I've gotten, you know, raked over the coals about balance and everything else. Right. And so, because one of the things I also liked, and I don't know if you guys noticed this already, but everybody needs the same experience points to go up. So a thief needs the same as a wizard, right? And I like doing that because it always bummed me out when the wizard's fourth level and the thief is seventh level, and the cleric is sixth level or fifth level or something, and they were always off kilter power wise. And I never really understood why, you know, fighters needed so many more experience points than, and then the tables got really wonky when you hit about seventh level, and then the wizard didn't exponentiate, but everybody else did. It's just like, you know, knock it off. And so we were really careful to, this took some effort too, man, to make sure that like the paladins for the first pass around, paladins sucked, right? They were just awful, and elves were terrible. And dwarves were kind of meh, and fighters were way too good. Okay. And thieves were way too good. And so the only thing I think I haven't modified a little bit with its abilities and stuff like that, is the cleric and the wizard, because I didn't feel like I needed to. And so the cleric and the wizard are pretty true to white box, but those are sort of your baselines. If you make a character class that's as good as a wizard or a cleric, you have succeeded. If you're going to make them get the same experience. And so the only exception to that was because we made the cleric the same as the wizard, we gave the cleric wizard spell progression instead of having no spell at first level and stuff like that. And having played a first level OD&D cleric was my very first character. Bummed me out. I didn't get a spell and the wizard did. So, but now I need 500 more experience points to go up.
I hear that. Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating.
So where else can I go?
I got to ask, we got you here. And you know, Bill, you get, when someone comes on the show, they got to be ready for the hard questions.
Sure.
And my question is, Paul and I have both, we haven't run all the way through, but Paul and I have both run sessions of Rappanathic. I think I ran it first, I believe. And so when we started out with the character, Paul was a player, I think, when we started out the first time. And the book that I had said very clearly not to go down the well. And I really leaned into it. And I was like, dude, you know, it says there's claw marks and there's dried blood and there's multiple things on the well. It says, do not enter Rappanathic by the well. Do not go down the well. And I tried to be as sincere as I possibly could. And the more that I talked about it, and they're definitely going to go down the freaking well. And I was like, clearly this couldn't possibly be right because there's horrible monsters down there. And then we went and played with you, and you started the session with, and there's a well, it says not go down the well, but you go down there anyway. And I turned to Paul, and I was like, what is going on? So my question is, in your normal original campaign, were people supposed to go down the well or not? Because I wrap my head around it.
So, and by the way, if we go over an hour, it's fine with me. I'm not doing anything other than going to watch my wife play music in about an hour. But so my home game group, you know, Zeb and Helen and John and Jillian and all those other guys that are playing in Rappanathic right now. And Helen Cook plays a druid. And so they're trying to figure out, you know, of course they heard the don't go down the well thing, and you know, and they're not trying to go down the well and everything else. And so Helen playing the druid goes out and, you know, uses locate animals to find, you know, she wanted to find river otters or muskrats or something that was swimming around rivers. Cause they also had the rumor that, you know, the rivers, you know, you could travel the rivers in through the dungeon, and you know, it's a good way to get inside the dungeon, and she could shapeshift. So she was like, okay, well, I can turn into a dolphin and go swim in there and take a look. Right. And so she didn't charm him, but she basically parlays with these two muskrats. And I roll a D6 for the muskrats, and like, okay, lore check for the muskrats, so they know anything about it. And I get a one, right? So the muskrats, yeah, man, they've been in the dungeon. The muskrat starts telling him the story about how he was with his friend, you know, Jerry, and Jerry stopped moving, and he turned around and he licked Jerry, and Jerry was made out of rock. You know, and of course, what it was is Jerry had gotten turned into stone by a basilisk. Right. And so, you know, Freddy the muskrat ran away because he got really scared. But then he makes friends with Helen, and she's talking to him, you know, and can you, you know, if you show me this, show me where it is, maybe we can help your friend. So they actually go in And they go into level 4A, right, which was the Basilisk Lair and that kind of thing. And they adventure in there for a while, and they're cruising around, beating around stuff in there. And they end up going up onto level 3A, which is the well, right? So they actually went up the well. So they beat Zelkor, to be fair. It was the big battle, the big boss fight we had over Christmas break was they fought Zelkor. And they're like 7th and 8th level characters at this point. But they defeated Zelkor and his two Iron Golems. Only because John and Rocco were home from college, so they had the 7th level fighter and the 7th level paladin, right, which made a huge difference. But they defeated Zelkor, so then they go out like, yeah, and they climb out, and I'm like, oh yeah, you come out of this well with these big scratch marks and stuff, and they're like, oh my god, we came up the well, you know, and so they actually put which was just cracking up. But yeah, it's, a lot of the snarky stuff, like the Beware of Purple Worms and all that other stuff, is historical play. So there was John Murdoch was the wizard player in college, and we played, like, you know, whenever we weren't chasing girls or drinking beer or doing homework, we were playing D&D. Yeah, so we probably played 4 or 5 times a week for 4 years. We're all in the same fraternity, that kind of thing. And John's character had one of those spells out of Unearthed Arcana. It was kind of like Wizard Mark or something. It's the obnoxious thing that basically creates glowing green graffiti all over your dungeon. Anyway, that guy painted stuff all over Rappanathic. And so some of the funnier ones, because I had it all written in my notes, you know, this one says Beware of Purple Worms, right? And this one says, you know, don't go down the well. So every place he put some of those things, a lot of those stayed in the text because it was kind of funny. Spiegel the Mage. And because they spent a lot of time in Rappanathic, the college group. They like dungeon crawling a lot.
Great.
They also friends with Wagon.
That's great. And you know, I also got to thank, now that I'm thinking about it, I got to thank you for the whole Purple Worm Cavern Complex actually inspired Paul and me. A couple of years ago, we made a tournament. A series of shows here that we called The Big Bad, and at least that season one there was an iteration of the Purple Worm Cavern in Rappanathic, actually, that we kind of converted a little bit and had a particular target, an evil cult and purple worms that people had to try to run through. And we had several teams run through it. One of them had our mutual friend Luke Gygax on it as a player. Yep. And we had a blast on that. So that was the kernel of our Big Bad show, actually, was that particular sequence from Rappanathic.
Nice. Yeah, I saw that you guys had Joe Manganiello on your show too. If you ever get a chance to play with him, do it. He's hilarious. He's played in a couple of my games. He plays a paladin, and he's like summoning these warhorse in the dungeon to charge the big monster at the very end. You know, and it was just like he was so gonzo. It was hilarious, absolutely hilarious. Yeah, Luke's fun to play with too. He's a good guy to roll dice with.
He knows what he's doing.
He's
3 or 4 years younger than me, and he's been playing as long as I have. So that says something, you know.
Totally.
So the other thing I wanted to mention, I don't know if Zach or Jen sent you the information on it, is I have a Patreon, and it is free to join it. And so, of course, you can give me money every month if you want to, but it's absolutely not a requirement. The people who do have paying memberships do get extra stuff, but I've got a lot of supporting material. I'm not doing the Patreon for the $300 a month or something that I make on it. I'm glad that I get $300 a month for part of our vacation next year, right? I'm a jerk if I don't get up and write something every day. And so since I started it in December or early January, I guess, I'm actually, first of all, I'm playing D&D with people from my Patreon once a week, which is kind of awesome, on a Zoom game. And then, so it forces me to have an extra D&D game. Damn. But more importantly, I've been posting stuff up there and kind of getting feedback from people. And it compels me. The power of Patreon compels me to write something every day. And I've been cranking. You know, usually, you know, before I did this thing, I was writing once or twice a week. And if you've written, then you have written stuff. You know, it's if you get 2,000 or 3,000 usable words a day, you're kind of kicking butt. But yeah. I've been knocking out, you know, probably 5 days a week. I've been getting that or more, and it's because I need to provide material to these folks who are supporting me on my Patreon. I think it's called the Frog Pond. I don't know if Jen sent you the links. It's it's the Frog
That's
Pond.
News to me, actually.
Okay. We'll make sure to have a link to that in the description of the video.
I'll let you guys link it. Yeah. But like I said, it is. Yeah. Nobody should feel compelled to pay me anything. If they want to, that'd be great. But I just like having a lot of people on there. I do post a lot of free stuff and previews. I use it as a writing tool more than I do as a money-making source, if that makes sense. It's not, you know, yeah. I built big, heavy military construction projects my whole career. I'm not making a break in my life on role-playing games. So
nothing like sense. A looming deadline to make the pen move, right?
Yeah. Well, that's just it. Like somebody, one of the people on the Patreon told me, they sent me a message, said, "Hey, what do you think about doing some alternate classes?" And that's where, and I was like, "Well, like what?" And he goes, "Make a lizard man." I was like, "All right, well, we'll make a lizard man class." You know, and because somebody had asked me, I think Edwin, one of my business partners, asked me to do a necromancer class. And I was like, I don't want that in the book. You know, it's as a add-on thing or a free download for people or as a stretch goal or something. That sounds great. But, you know, I want the kind of the core classes in there. Probably could have put the barbarian in, you know, to make it an even 12 instead of 11. But, yeah, why not? Honestly, the barbarians, I haven't really tuned that one up yet. I think it's too weak. So that was the consensus of my guys yesterday. So it may have to get some sort of extra something. So somebody on Patreon asked me to write a Lizard Man class. So I wrote a Lizard Man class and sent it out to everybody. What do you guys think? And I got a lot of feedback on it. People liked it. By and large, there were a couple of really great suggestions that they made. Most importantly was they, you know, that at level 5 or higher, the thing gets a magical bite so it can bite a ghost. You know, just like any other 4-hit dive.
Nice. That's great.
And then, you know, it has some negatives about it. Like it's scary, so it gets -4 on parlay checks with humans and humanoids. And of course, it has a swim. It has a really good swim ability and slow movement. You know, and like then the barbarian moves fast, but you know but he can't wear playmail. You know, stuff like that, And then the rage mechanic, I call it bite the shield. And then I figured out a way to kind of make that so it worked for White Box. It doesn't give you +4/+4 like I think it did in 3.0. You get +2, you know, it gives you +2. +4 is a lot, you know, in D6 based game.
We are just about out of time here. So before we do run out, I wanted to make sure that you got a chance to pitch anything else about the upcoming or current Kickstarter. At the time of recording this, Kickstarter hasn't quite gone live yet, but by the time this is out on the air, it should be active and going.
Absolutely.
So anything else you want to tell our viewers about it?
So really, really the biggest pitch I'll give on this, and as you guys, of course, have seen it, first of all, it looks a lot better than that in its final form, but it's okay. That's the beta draft. Those are collectible, though.
It's only nice already. 60,
70, yeah. So the Necromancer's game, the biggest pitch I'll really give for it is it's a game that's simple enough that people can learn it really easily. It's absolutely base. It's a White Box game that is intentionally made to be a long-term play. So you can run it as one-offs, but it's not designed as a one-off game. It's designed as a campaign type game. And then the other point that I guess I've added really good non-combat mechanics that are simple to use and are resolved typically with one die roll. And the biggest thing about it is I think I might be the first guy in history to make a White Box game that's not a murder hobo game. And so it is based on using your head and treating the characters like you would if you were them. So, you know, if you see the sleeping ancient red dragon in your first level, it doesn't make any sense to go smack the thing, right? If you're a hobbit, maybe you want to talk to it. You guys read, I don't know if you guys saw the Hobbit abilities, but they have the, if they're by themselves, they have the riddles in the dark thing where they can talk the monsters out of you.
Yes, I thought that's really clever, Bill.
Because none of the monsters know what they are. They're like, what the hell is that? Are you a little kid? You know? And, um, But you know, so obviously that's liberally borrowed from Tolkien, right? But it's I think anybody who's played with me knows that my games are really, they're thinking people's games, and they're much more based on role playing than they are on dice rolling. And I think that I think I've done a pretty good job, especially in the Game Master's Guide, of talking about how that's easy to do and easy to run. And I honestly, I think this thing could be run by anybody from about the age of 10 or 11 to the age of 80. And it will remind people a lot of the late 70s and early 80s styles games, and where we did not fight everything. And you ran away a lot, and you figured out ways to get the gold. You don't get a lot of, I only give 10 hit experience points for combat is trivial in the game. It's achieving objectives and getting gold, you know, and getting and doing stuff like building a church if you're a priest, or building a castle if you're a fighter. That's how you get experience points.
Yeah. Yep.
Any other questions?
Please check out the link. We'll include it here with the video. So hopefully by the time this goes live, it should be down there, and it is live and going. So please check out the link and back the Necromancer's game.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. I'm happy to come back anytime. Just let me know when you want me on the show and send me an email. I'm happy to be here, whatever. I love doing stuff like this.
That's the best. So viewers, if you want to leave any comments about other things, you want to see the next time that we get Bill Webb of Necromancer Games on, we'd love to see that. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, GitHub. We have the handle Wandering Dems on all those sites. So please look for us there and animate that like button.
And if you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com, as well as various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you are actually listening to this show right now on one of those carriers, please take a moment, if they offer the ability to do so, to rate and review our show. That helps other users find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, big, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show here at Wandering DMs. If you'd like to join them, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/wanderingdms. And we're not quite as nice as Bill. We have a $1 tier, but we do ask that you join the tribe with maybe at the $1 level or one of the higher levels. Yeah. And every level does get you access to our private Discord server, where the conversation continues 24/7. And we get great ideas for our games and other people's games and upcoming shows and things that you would like to see other great guests like Bill. So Bill, thank you so much. We hope that the Kickstarter is a great super success for the Necromancer's game. Again, we have the link in the description on YouTube, so we hope that people will go there and join in. Also look for Bill's Patreon at Frog Pond. We hope the Kickstarter is a smashing success. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you guys too.
And so don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.